RadioInfluence.com.
We're getting festive. It's a holiday edition of We've Seen That. We are back in here for another edition of our digital movies podcast based on the 80s, 90s, and more. I am your somewhat lucid host. I have not spent an abundance of time in the malls as of yet. He is my partner. I love the insight on all of these great movies, the humor, the facts, the trivia, and getting to share time talking about them with the famous Jay Betzel, who is based in the Dallas-Fort Worth area of Texas. I'm based in West Central Florida in the Tampa-St. Pete Clearwater area. Patna, good to be back with you, and it's going to be good to talk a little holiday movie, a little Thanksgiving movie at the time we're taping this. I don't know if the audience can figure it out from the theme, but I'm ready to have some fun.
For sure. I've been waiting to do Planes, Trains, and Automobiles since we started.
Yeah, well, and it's only appropriate because it's based in and around Thanksgiving, and it's such a fun film that we're going to talk about here on this edition of the program. A reminder, we've seen that on Twitter, Facebook, and also Instagram. You can look us up and you can find us as we analyze these different movies. So yes, if you've ever had travel problems, in particular in and around a holiday, this is a great movie, right, Jay? Just real quick before we get into the particulars.
Let's put it this way. If you ever have time to sit in an airport waiting on a delayed flight, you can hear us on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, Radio Influence. There's all kinds of ways to hear us. And this time of year, there's lots of chances to get on and explore the podcast universe.
And the likelihood is you're not going to have the amount of delays for the amount of time and the amount of craziness that Steve Martin and John Candy had in this movie. It might be close. You might be delayed. And if you are delayed, we encourage you to listen to the show. Are you ready to do this officially?
Let's do it.
During holiday travel, some people get delirious. Some get delayed. And some get Del Griffin.
American Lighting Fixture, Director of Sales, Shower Curtain Ring Division.
Neil Page got all three.
I was on my way home to spend a nice holiday with my family. Instead, I'm in a motel bed with a stranger.
So instead of Thanksgiving with his family, he's spending 3 days with the turkey.
Two happy clams just whistling down the road.
Flintstones, meet the Flintstones. They're the modern Tony's family.
Paramount Pictures presents
Wilma!
Steve Martin.
Ever been to Hawaii?
Yeah.
You see Don Ho while you were there?
See the second show, that's the best one.
Is that right?
Yeah.
John Candy.
Why are you holding my hand? Where's your other hand? Between two pillows.
Those aren't pillows.
In a new film by John Hughes. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
See that Bears game last week?
Yeah, hell of a game, hell of a game.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It was released November 25th, 1987 from Paramount Pictures. It opened at number 3. It grossed a little over $7 million its first weekend. For a domestic total, it ended up with $49 million. On its opening weekend, like I said, it was number 3. It finished right behind 3 Minute Baby was number 1. A reissue of Cinderella, and it finished just ahead of Fatal Attraction and The Running Man.
How about
some big,
that?
Big hitters there.
Did better than Fatal Attraction on the opening weekend of the movie.
In all fairness, it was Fatal Attraction's 11th week. But we know Fatal Attraction was quite the big hit back in the day. Now, Steve Martin-wise, let's see how this looks on his box office. If you adjust for ticket price inflation, it is number 13 for Steve Martin. It would be adjusted $114
million. Okay,
wait.
Number 13 of all of his movies? I don't know how many Steve Martin movies that I can name off the top of my head. I certainly can't name 12 other ones. That astounds me without having looked at his IMDb.
Why don't you throw a couple out and we'll see.
Well, The Jerk is obviously the one that everybody would know.
It's number one.
The most.
$268 million adjusted.
On that. What is the one that I'm thinking? It's Roxanne, right, with Daryl Hannah, where he plays
Roxanne is behind Planes, Trains,
Automobiles. You've got to be kidding me. That movie wouldn't be in front of it. I'm gonna run low probably. All of Me is a good little musical love story comedy.
It is number 14, also behind Plane, Trains, Automobiles.
Okay, I'm like out of ammunition here. What else is in front of this? Give me several. Go.
Well, I'll give you a little rundown. Number 2, Parenthood. Number 3, yes. Cheaper by the Dozen.
Okay.
And Bringing Down the House. We have number 5, one of my all-time favorites, Father of the Bride.
Yep.
Then we have number 7, Father of the Bride Part 2. We have...
See, I know what part of my problem... If I can interject, I know what my part of my problem is. As a father of now 10-year-old twin girls, I'm trying to block out any and all references to weddings, much less double weddings, Father of the Bride, Father of the Bride Part 2. That I'm like blocking that out of my subconscious right now, if I possibly can, on that.
Well,
I don't know how I glossed over Parenthood in particular, which is a really good one. Speaking of parents that can identify with that one on a lot of different fronts, a Ron Howard film. Maybe we've seen that down the road. Who knows, from the early 90s, but that's amazing. Okay, keep going. I didn't mean to sidetrack you. What else?
No, you're right, fine. Right in front? We've also got House Sitters there. Yeah. Bowfinger with Eddie Murphy. We have It's Complicated, the movie where he was with Alec Baldwin and Meryl Streep. It's a really funny movie. It's a recent one, 2009. And then Cheaper by the Dozen 2. And the Pink Panther remake from 2006.
Oh, terrible. That movie. Because I was such a fan of Peter Sellers as the Pink Panther in the Steve Martin remake. Nowhere close. Not good enough. Enough on that front.
Let's hit a couple from the year of 1987. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Let's see where it finished. It finished number 21.
Interesting.
For the year. So we've been through 87 a couple times. We've talked about it. You know, this is a year kind of in our wheelhouse. Beverly Hills Cop 2, yep. 3 Men and a Baby, yep. Fatal Attraction, Good Morning Vietnam, The Untouchables, The Original Lethal Weapon, Steakhouse, Secret of My Success, The Original RoboCop, The Original Predator, Dirty Dancing, Eddie Murphy Raw. There's a lot of movies. I mean, this is a really good year. And these are the ones that finished ahead of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, this might surprise you, TJ, finished ahead of Wall Street.
Yeah, how about that? In front of Michael Douglas, Charlie Sheen, Gordon Gekko, and the whole Wall Street thing. All right, so the movie did well at the box office. We know about Steve Martin. Tell me more about John Candy, because this is an iconic role in his career for John Candy. Not just the usual comedy only, but this one really had some great story behind it. So tell me more.
You know, we lost John Candy at an early age. He was 43 when he died back in March of 1994. You know, but the funny thing is he left us with a lot of big movies. Do you have like a favorite John Candy?
This one is up there. There, I mean, he's great in Splash with Tom Hanks, which was one of his first ones. There's probably three.
I remember seeing Splash as a kid when he's dropping the quarters.
Right.
Looking up the girl's dress.
Remember the line, "When something works for me, I stick with it."
Yeah, stick with it.
So, yes, I mean, Uncle Buck, we know all about, and on and on for John
Candy. There's a couple I really like I want to mention. Brewster's Millions, where he played Richard Pryor with the money. And I really like that Volunteers with Tom Hanks, where he played Tom Tuttle from Tacoma. The guy just wouldn't shut up, and everybody called him Tom Tuttle from Tacoma.
Not unlike kind of what Dell is here in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Can't stop talking.
But he was a Peace Corps version of Dell. So then another one I really liked was The Great Outdoors.
Yes.
This was another John Hughes collaboration. John Hughes actually wrote that, had him, Dan Aykroyd. I really enjoyed that one. You know, he was in Home Alone for a minute. He was the polka singer that eventually they got the mom home. He had a small role in JFK, the Oliver Stone movie from 91 with Kevin Costner.
Yeah, he's like the New Orleans lawyer, right? With the black sunglasses and the white suit and the whole mystery behind, you know, what really happened according to Oliver Stone. Okay,
yeah,
I got you on that.
There's one last one I want to mention I really liked was Cool Runnings. Did you see that?
Yes.
The Jamaican bobsled team.
Very well done.
Really liked that one.
And the punchline, again, is that it's a true story about the Jamaican bobsled team and what really happened, and he's their instructor, he's their coach. So love
it,
John
Candy.
It kind
of gives you the chills, too. It's a fun movie to watch.
Yes, love John Candy, and again... it's amazing that he's been gone almost 25 years at the time that we're taping this. It's amazing that John Hughes now has been gone for several years. We've talked previously on other we've seen that, including The Breakfast Club and other ones that we've done, about his impact in particular in the 80s. Always seemed to be a around high
school
movies.
He died
movies.
Actually August of 2009, so we're coming up on 10
that?
Years.
That's amazing.
That's
but,
crazy.
But the fact that he dealt so many times and ways with high school movies or with young people, young adults, and in this case, he goes older in this one with Steve Martin's Neil, John Candy's Dell, and them trying to get home to their families for Thanksgiving. So I kind of like that about this. He ventures out of what the normal pattern of movies had been for John Hughes.
Well, he's got, you know, the vacation movies are his, you know, so he's got a lot of movies that are similar to this as well from the standpoint of families and, you know, and holidays. So I think this kind of fits in his wheelhouse. It's just a little different because it's not a big cast. It's essentially you've got a couple other people you'll recognize in the movie. You know, Kevin Bacon's in at the beginning. Michael McKean is the state trooper. But for the most part, this is the Steve Martin and John Candy show.
Yeah, no doubt. They're the two guys that are being featured through most of this. And I didn't remember until I saw it again recently about Kevin Bacon being in this one as the taxi racer as it goes along. And so not a huge cast of a lot of big time names around them. But I mean, these guys are clearly the stars. They're the guys being featured through most of the film, through their odyssey, let's call it, trying to get from New York to Chicago.
Well, let's kind of dive right into the movie. You know, the movie starts, it's really funny. The part where they're in this meeting and his boss is looking at the, I guess, some presentation they've done.
Right.
You know, and he's staring at his watch. He knows he needs to get to the airport. He knows he's going to be running late. And, you know, who has not been through this if you've had a job where the boss basically wastes your time and says, we'll reconvene after the holidays.
Exactly.
So the entire thing was a waste of time. And, you know, he's sitting next to, for people from the 90s, remember, or sorry, from the 80s, you have Ferris Bueller's dad is the one that's sitting with him.
Right,
in
exactly.
The, you know, in the office there, you know, basically trying to tell him, you know, you should just take a later flight and this and that. But he's wants to get home to Chicago from New York, wants to be, you know, be with his family. And then, you know, the kind of trek, if you will, to try to hail a cab during rush hour in New York. That's kind of comic in his own right. Have you ever been in New York and had to do that?
Oh, yeah. No question about that being crazy. In fact, at the time we're taping, I was just in New York. And of course, that whole world has changed in terms of cabs and transportation with Uber and what Uber does and the convenience of it. In fact, I was at the hotel trying to get to a restaurant actually in New Jersey, in Jersey City, New Jersey. And the guys downstairs were like, yeah, don't take the cabs that are out there. Just get an Uber real quick because the cabs are more expensive. So I ended up taking an Uber. But yeah, a lot of people can't understand or relate to what went on in the 80s where there was no internet. You didn't have an app on your phone that could check you in for the airline at the airport or get you there via Uber in an automobile and do all of this digitally. So when he's sitting there looking at his watch, he's realizing I may very well miss my flight here to be able to get back to my family.
Yeah, and he knows what he's up against. And it's funny, you know, the first time I went to New York, we flew into JFK, and we stayed at the Four Seasons on Madison and 57th. So we took a cab from the airport, and it was a set rate because the
right.
cab drivers were so shady. They would, you know, hey, you ever been to New York? Here, let me show you the way
right,
around. Right,
exactly.
The scenic tour, and ended up being $200 by
the scenic tour that is the same as a house payment. And so that's why they passed laws regulating this. You're exactly right, because of exactly what you're describing, that they would gouge the daylights out of tourists.
Yeah, well, and you know, that definitely would have happened to me because that was the first time I'd been to New York City or to anything like that. I'd been to L.A., I'd been to places, you know, Houston, Dallas, stuff. But the first time I went to New York, it was like, wow, this is really big. So that was kind of my – I'd obviously seen Planes, Trains, and Automobiles before I'd been. So I was kind of looking around when I was there kind of thinking this is what he was dealing with. There's no way he didn't have a chance. So obviously he ends up he hails a cab, but he loses it to Kevin Bacon. So then he basically pays off a guy to get a cab, right?
Right.
And in the meantime, while he's paying him off, Dell steals it from him.
Well, right.
Dell takes advantage and loads it up while Steve Martin's paying the guy.
Well, right. And so he's being sly in that regard and ends up getting the cab. And of course, Steve Martin is famously chasing behind the cab. It's my cab, you know, running
out.
Well,
the guy said, well, anybody that would pay this would certainly pay this. He's like, not necessarily. So he ends up getting to the airport and to board the plane. And he sees Dell. They're on the same plane, coincidentally. And Dell Griffith's shower curtain ring salesman, should we say. And, of course, the plane is diverted to Wichita due to the big blizzard in Chi-Town.
Well, and that's
That's where the fun starts.
Well, that's what sets the movie into motion here, where the two of them have already been introduced through the whole thing with the cab, and then reintroduced that they're on the same plane, and now they're stuck along with everybody else. And you know, it just strikes you that, you know, Steve Martin's got a family that he's trying to get home to, and he's got a successful business career, obviously. But he's
Kevin Bacon beat him to the cab, didn't he trip over Dell's trunk in the first place?
I think he did, and that's funny. Because they show you that trunk, and that trunk is going to become a part of the movie as the movie goes on, and then with the ending of the movie. But most people can identify with, hey, it doesn't matter what walk of life that you're from. If you're dealing with a commercial airline and the flight gets canceled or delayed or diverted, you're all in the same boat here where you're scrambling. Is there another airplane? Okay, there's not. Where are we going to stay? Where are we going to sleep? And so Neil has to go into that mode with all the other passengers and try to figure it out. We talk about this a lot,
if this was today, those lines at the payphones, that wouldn't happen now because everybody has their right. own cell phones. But that just looks so miserable. And then when Dell says to Neil, basically, you called home, I called the Braidwood Inn. You know, I sold the guy's shower curtain rings. I can probably get him to give you a room if you want to pick up the cab fare. he's just a total salesman all the way around. And he ends up getting a free cab out of it. And then he sees his alternative is the people sleeping on the floor. He's like, yeah, I'll do that.
Yes, because Dell understands how to get things done. And you're so right that like in the late 1980s, you did not have a way off your handheld device to be able to line up your hotel room or your new flight, et cetera, et cetera. You're going to have to go use a payphone, or you're going to have to wheel and deal somehow, some way with a connection on a phone somewhere. So it's fascinating how all of this, when you go back and you watch these movies, like, how did we ever exist where we couldn't do everything in 5 minutes on a phone, Jay Petzl?
When I mentioned the scenic tour that I would have gotten when I flew into JFK, he gets the scenic tour in Wichita and even says to Dell, he's like, where are we going? He's like, why didn't we take the expressway? He's like, well, you said your friend never been here. I thought he might like to see the place. He's in the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night in the winter, yes, where it's freezing cold.
Dell's like, you know, the guy's damn proud of where he lives. That doesn't happen very often. it's just the whole thing is so funny. And, you know, and so they end up getting to the Braidwood Inn. And then how'd that go?
Not necessarily so well, because they're trying to figure out how to pay for the room. And then Neil knows how to do the only thing he knows how to do, which is he ends up having to try to trade his watch to be able to get a room.
No, that's later on.
Wait a minute, that's
the
later.
The first one they get to is where they have the one room left and it's got the double bed.
And they have to stay together.
Yeah,
right.
The last room in the house is what they have. So they're in the same room. And that's when we're talking about doing this earlier, I told you I had some funny little traveled anecdotes that I wanted to throw in. So a little sidebar here. This is my version of that, what happened to him at this hotel. So back, I've written for a bunch of different publications over time. And back about 4 or 5 years ago, as TJ had mentioned earlier, I'm based here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And just south of us, about 3 or 4 hours, is Austin, the state capital. They got this new racetrack at the time. It was called Circuit of the Americas. And the guy that's the publisher of the magazine I was writing for said, he asked if I'd like to go down and cover this event there. And I told him, I'm not really interested in it, but I'll go down just to see the new venue, right? And I said, but I'm not driving. I do not want to deal with I-35 and deal with getting down to Austin.
Because on the drive, without traffic, it's how far?
Oh, without traffic, about 3 hours. But that
with traffic?
I-35 is what goes from Mexico to Canada and cuts through DFW and San Antonio and everything. It always has traffic. It's just a nightmare.
So you were easily looking at 4 hours, 5 hours in the car just to get from Dallas to Austin. At least.
I mean, probably four hours max. But, you know, it's still – For people that know, I don't really like driving. I'd rather be driven, or I'd rather ride around. I don't like driving because I like to do things. I don't like to be having to actually pay attention, you know, and all that kind of fun stuff. So cross-country travel, I'd rather jump on a plane. I don't want to drive. So anyways, I tell the guys, like, I'll do it, but I'm not going to drive. So he connects me with the photographer that put in for the credentials. Photographer calls me. It's this he's got kind of a hillbilly voice, so I'll try and do the best I can. He calls me and says, hey, Jay, just want to let you know we got Peru for the race down there. And Kelly said you didn't want to drive, so I figured, you know, we set up a couple things, you know, and I'll get us a hotel room and everything, and we'll be good to go. So I'm like, yeah. I was like, I'm good with that, but I refuse to drive. I don't want any part of driving. So this is about a month out, right?
Right.
So the week comes, you know, I don't know this guy. I mean, I've talked to him a few times. I mean, we know each other, but I don't know him enough to talk to him. So the week arrives, and we talk on Monday, and we plan, yeah, we're going to go down on Saturday, and we'll meet up that morning and you know, jump in his car and what I'll help him pay for the gas, right? It's just worth it to me to not have to deal with driving into Austin traffic. So I digress. Get to Thursday, he calls me. Hey, Jay, I decided to come on down here and check the place out, see what's like. So I'll just see you down here on Saturday, I guess. I got a friend's house. I'm going to stay for a couple days. So just let me know when you get to town. So I almost dropped my phone.
Now you are in the middle of a Jay crisis because you're going to have to drive.
I'm irritated. I'm not crisis mode quite yet. So I called the publisher and said, that idiot drove down there without me. And I was like, so I'm not going to end up going. Well, it's a brand new venue. I don't want to, you know, get blackballed by the brand new venue. So if you'll drive down there, I'll pay for your gas. Just get the receipts and send them to me so I can put them in the books. I'm like, I really don't want to go. And you know, but essentially I gave in and I did it. So Saturday I call him on my way down there and say, okay, I'm heading down there. And he says, well, I was able to get us a motel. Like, you know, he said a month earlier, oh, I've got it. We're good. But now he acts like he's some hero for getting it because not only is this race there, but there's another big convention in town. So he says, he gives me the address to it. So I type it in my phone, heading down there. I get down. It's a Motel 6 right off 35. It's got, you know, chain link fence up around it. And there's tall grass that hadn't been mowed in probably a year.
All year.
Weeds
right,
everywhere. I end up getting there. Sure as hell, he didn't even try to get a hotel till I was heading down there. He gets this hotel that's not the nicest accommodation, shall we say. And I've been to some okay Motel 6s where I've been traveling. This just didn't happen to not be one of them. And we get in there, and I kid you not, it's a queen-size bed. That's it.
It's you and this guy reenacting Dell and Neil and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm seriously looking at it like I drove down here for this, and he's like, well, you know, I mean, I figured, you know, I mean, I don't mind staying in the same bed, and I was like, hell no. so it gets even better. So then he says, well, let's go out to eat and we'll see if we can figure something out. I mean, we can go grab something to eat. And I said, well, we need to find a Target or Walmart or something because I need to get an air mattress because I'm not sleeping in that small bed, you know. And so we end up going to eat at Twin Peaks, and he lets me pay for the dinner since he I got the hotel. I'll just take care of that. You just get dinner. I sit there and watch him just shoving these French fries in his mouth. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. This really isn't happening. So anyways, we end up going over to Walmart after my $60 dinner. We go over to Walmart and I drop 25 or 30 bucks on this air mattress I'm sleeping on the floor, this wooden floor next with my head next to the door. And so anyways, we get back to the hotel/motel and there's a couple of cop cars sitting in the parking lot, right? So I walk over and I ask one of the cops, I said, you know, hey, we're media guys. We're down here to cover this race at Circuit of Americas. And I was kind of looking around. This looks like it's kind of a sketchy neighborhood. Are we safe? And they both started laughing like I was telling a joke. And one of them says, well, it depends on your idea of what a bad neighborhood would be. And the other guy says, I'm sure there's worse areas in downtown Detroit.
Oh.
And I looked over at this photographer that I'm with, and his head just shrugged. I mean, he didn't do one thing right like we had planned, and I already didn't want to go. It's not like we're going to the Super Bowl or something I really wanted to do, you know? So anyways, needless to say, that was about the worst trip I could have ever imagined. The venue was amazing. We did some Red Bull bicycle or, you know, motorcycle race that I haven't watched or anything since, but it was a lot of fun to go and see it and experience it. On the way back, it took 6 hours and 30 minutes for me to get home.
Because
I-35 is down to one lane, and that moron calls me, hey, are you sitting in traffic too? And I said, shockingly, I am. What made you think that? You know, by now, I'm totally done with dealing with this guy. He goes, well, I'm almost awake. I was going to see if you wanted to stop and grab something to eat.
He wanted to go back for another meal at Twin Peaks.
I told him, exactly right. So I told him, I was like, no offense, but this is the worst trip I've ever had in my whole life, and I just want to get home. And I'm afraid if I get off the highway, I might not ever get back on. So
now the only question I have, well, I actually have two questions. Did you ever make a Planes, Trains, and Automobiles reference around this guy, even though it would have gone over his head? Did any of that ever come across your mind and
lips?
In my
mind I was, but I was getting more aggravated and irritated by the second.
And the second thing is, did he eventually try to sell you any shower curtain rings? No, that did not happen.
Shockingly, he did not. But, I mean, he definitely, he didn't do his part. Let's put it that way.
Wow. So Jay survived a trip to Austin. Now, but that didn't involve an airplane. It didn't involve a train. It just involved an automobile and then the room. And I love that, where you got one room with two guys and you go and get the air mattress. Now, our audience might want to know one. We've seen that here. Did you do the thing that a lot of people do and now the retail stores have caught on to it? Did you go try to return the air mattress the next day and get your money back from Walmart? Because
no, I actually took it to the publisher of the magazine's house and let him pay for it when I went to go pick up my money for my gas.
Same difference. I like that, though. Now he had an air mattress for that. All right. So at this point, we got to get back to the movie because they've stayed in the hotel. They have the big moment where they're snuggling in the bed, which I would love to know how much of that was actually scripted and how much of that John Candy and Steve Martin both have improv acting big time in their background. How much was any of that just improv dialogue with them in the bed? I've got my hand between two pillows. Those aren't pillows. Oh,
hell of a game.
How about those Bears? They're going to be great this year. Hell of a team. Yes.
When you've got Steve Martin washing his face off with John Candy's underwear because he took all the towels. I mean, it's just one of those things where anything that could possibly go wrong. I mean, they could have easily called this Murphy's Law, if you will. So the next thing they do is they get into a little bit of an argument, right? Because Neil kind of loses his temper, starts calling him like a chatty Cathy doll with it pulls its own string, and then Dell says that he's cold hearted. But they end up, in fact, don't they get their money stolen?
Yeah, right. Because
somebody
comes in the room while they're snuggling and snoring and not realizing it, and steals their money and their valuables and everything out of the room. On top of everything else, when you talk about staying in a bad part of town, so they
end up trying to take the train to Chicago, and I guess what Dell sells the shower curtain rings to a bunch of idiots that think they're earrings, to end up getting them bus tickets because of course the train, breaks down and they have to carry that big trunk across a field through Missouri. It's just one of those things. Like, it's one thing after another. And like, have you ever taken a train trip anywhere?
I've been on a train a couple of different times, not for long amounts of times, maybe only for a couple of hours, and certainly not cross country like this over the course of a day or two. It might be fun to do. And this was a much bigger deal and way to travel even earlier in the mid 1900s, the 1950s, 60s, 70s. People would take trains more. That's become less and less, with air travel being what it is and private aircraft that people can take and blah blah blah. So, but I mean, that trunk is—it's the indelible image of the movie. That trunk is in the way from the beginning. It is something that's a burden, and then we're going to find out later on the punchline why the trunk is so significant for Dell and his life. But I've been on trips too. I can relate. Where you get delayed in an airport and you've got a connection you're going to miss, and now you're in the airport for 6 hours, and then you're trying to figure out, how can we get there? Are we going to rent a car? Are we going to miss the event? And then you end up reciting something from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It just, even though the movie is more than 30 years old now, I still will make a reference to what Neil and Dell went through there over their few days trying to get home for Thanksgiving.
Well, we talked about, if you're driving from one spot to another, and in this one, remember, Dell throws a cigarette in the back seat and the car catches on fire. Now, is that before or after? I think it's after the fact when they're driving down the wrong way, right?
Well, right, because Dell is driving and they're both half asleep and they've got the heat on in the car and it's making them drowsy. And he ends up getting on the wrong way entrance onto the interstate. And I love
the
that part.
People next to him are like, you're driving in the wrong direction.
You're going the wrong way. They're yelling at him. And he says, how do they know which way we're going? And then he starts signaling like you're drunk and acts like he's pouring a drink with his hands.
Yeah,
in his mouth.
Steve Martin's like, thank you.
Yes, thank you, thank you. You on that, but it turns out they are, and then they have the semi come at them. By the way, my wife and I still to this day, and even my mother, who loves this movie, will quote, "You're going the wrong way." Whenever we see a wrong way sign, and we're pulling into a parking lot, or we're on an expressway or whatever, and we see the wrong way signs, you're going the wrong way. Yes, so it does resonate all these years later. But yes, they eventually burn up the rental car, and that's going to be another fact. And Neil is basically losing his mind over and over again and becoming more and more irritated here that the more they try to do, Dell screws it up and he burns up the rental car.
And in that particular instance, was trying to think, that's when they they destroyed the credit cards and everything, correct?
Right, they're burned up in the car.
They all catch up.
Well,
first, on fire. That's
first
right.
They catch on fire, and so Neil is thinking, okay, well, that's not that big a deal because this is on your credit card. And then he says to him, well, they screwed it up, and it's actually on your credit card. And oh, by the way, the credit cards are now burned up where they can't use them anymore inside the automobile to help them out.
It was a diner's club, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think something like that.
And John Candy had like a discount travel card or whatever.
The sad part, I don't know about your family, but I still remember my family had the Diners Club card. So I can identify with that when you just said that. I can remember us having the Diners Club card for the discounts and the food and the different stuff. And of course, Michael McKeon is the state trooper that comes and questions them when they're trying to drive the car that's all burned up. And you will know that the face more so than the name from Laverne and Shirley. I mean, the role from that sitcom on ABC in the late 1970s and early 80s. Lenny and Squiggy from Laverne and Shirley. That's Michael McKeon. But he's the state trooper that comes up and he basically says, you got no functioning gauges. This is not highway safe. I can't let you drive the car. And Dale's trying to bribe him with whatever he can bribe him with, but they're screwed. I mean, they're going to impound the burned up rental car and they're stuck for another few hours or half a day trying to figure out how we're going to get home.
I missed one part because they go to the hotel and that's where he sells his watch to the motel clerk to get the room.
Right.
And then Dale, of course, doesn't have any money, so he has to go sleep out in the car, which has no roof.
Exactly.
And, you know, Neil is so annoyed by Dale the whole time. He just, you know, from the onset, you know, and every time they're split, whether they're split on the train or whatever, they always end up kind of coming back to one another. You know, and here's one. He sees him sitting out in the car, and of course he has a heart, so he starts feeling sympathetic, and he invites him to come in because it's snowing out there, you know, and the two of them start drinking some of because Dell's got like the little shots that he steals off the airlines, so they start, you know, laughing about the last couple of days, and it's kind of one of those where, you know, it's kind of a bonding moment, if you will, but then that's whenever their car gets impounded and they end up riding in the back of that truck to get back to Chicago, right?
Right. That's where Dylan Baker, as Owen and his wife, agree to drive them and try to help them get back to Chicago and get to the train station. So, yes, they're going through the rural part of the Midwest, trying to get from Wichita, Kansas, and eventually get to Chicago and get there for Thanksgiving. And that leads to the big climactic part. They're coming up to the end. But, I you know, I'll share this. I've been on trips before with teams on travel, with teams going to cover sporting events and games. We had one in particular where we were going to get to, we were having to fly to New Orleans from Tampa to New Orleans. We were going to have to drive another 90 minutes from New Orleans to Hattiesburg, Mississippi for a basketball game with the University of Southern Mississippi, which is in Hattiesburg. Brett Favre's school made it famous, obviously, that university. So anyway, we were delayed leaving in the first place. Luckily, it's a nonstop flight to get to New Orleans. We get there, we get our stuff, we get on the bus. This was the same bus driver with the same bus company that we had had on other trips that had driven us, because we would also play Tulane University in New Orleans, and he would invariably be the bus driver as well with the same bus company that would come pick us up and keep us in New Orleans for a game there. So we got to know him. The bus driver, it was a great guy, older black gentleman named Ace, and Ace was the best. And so Ace has us, and we're rolling along towards the interstate, and Ace says, I've got a problem. He goes, I don't know what's going on, but my gauges are going crazy, and we're going to have to try to make it to the depot here. And of course, the head coach is going crazy because we're on a schedule, you know, because I believe on that trip we had flown in the daytime and we're trying to get to Hattiesburg to get to the basketball arena because they were going to practice a little bit in the arena the night before the game. So this is delaying all of that. So that's the problem. Well, little did we know what the delay was, because this is Friday. We're in the rush hour traffic. He's trying to make it to the bus depot because the bus is dying. The bus is having an electrical problem and is dying. It's just cropped up. So we get to the bus depot and they tell us the bad news, that bus is broken down. And Jay, they tell us the worst news. They don't have another bus for us to be able to get to Hattiesburg, that the bus company does not have another bus at its disposal. They're trying to find one. And we end up sitting, and I still remember this, the old school VHS worked on this bus. So this is at least a 15-year-old story. And so we end up watching an entire movie. I want to say the movie is Rounders, which could be another, we've seen that, with Matt Damon, John Malkovich, Edward Norton. We watched the entire movie from opening credits movie to finishing credits while sitting at the bus depot, where eventually the bus company essentially rented a bus from another company, paid for it, and said, hey, can you get us another bus here? We've got to get the basketball team to Hattiesburg, Mississippi at some point this evening, and they still got a 90-minute drive. So we sat there and waited for 2.5 more hours to try to get there. And Hattiesburg is in the middle of nowhere anyway, in Mississippi, in South Mississippi. So it was our little mini version of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. We did not have to take a train, though. It was just the plane and the train. We eventually
did
get there.
Didn't have anybody in there with a trunk that you had to carry?
I didn't have to carry a trunk. And we eventually did get there. And as I recall, we won the basketball game. And then the bus got us back to New Orleans. And we got on the plane and we left on Sunday. It was a 2.5-day odyssey, but it worked out in terms of winning and losing. And makes for a great story. Here it is on the We've Seen That podcast.
Do you have I know you've traveled a lot more than me with your work and stuff. Do you have any fun any fun plane stories?
Well, there's all kinds of ones where planes, you know, get canceled for whatever reason. You know, sometimes it's weather, but sometimes I was on one time, and I can honestly say this is a probably 20-year-old story. I've never experienced this one again. I literally, Jay, fly probably 20 times a year still, traveling on charter aircraft with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, which, you know, I'm part of their radio broadcast, but I also fly commercially for other things with work easily another 10 times. I might fly as many as 25 times in a given year, give or take. I've never had this one since, where we loaded the plane, we were ready to go. I still remember it was an old US Air. US Air has now been swallowed up by what? I think United is now US Air. I can't ever keep it straight on which one's merged with who. Did American gobble this one? Did United gobble that one? Did Delta gobble this one? But the old US Air would fly nonstop out of Tampa to a few different places. One of them was Pittsburgh. We were supposed to fly to Pittsburgh again. I think this was for a basketball game. We board the plane, and this, you talk about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles type story. We board the plane. We're on the plane. We're getting ready to take off, but we don't taxi. We don't pull back from the gate. We sit. Everybody's on the plane. Do we have a problem? Do we have a mechanical problem? Do we have an engine problem? The captain comes on and goes, ladies and gentlemen, I apologize, but I'm about to explain to you what the delay is and what the situation is. We had a ground crew here that assisted us with maintenance on the plane, and one of their jobs is to check and refuel the plane and put oil in the engine and make sure, because this plane has already been used today, that it has everything we need with fuel and with oil. And unfortunately, the crew has apparently put the wrong oil in the engine. They are not for certain, and we cannot take the chance. And of course, I'm sitting back at this moment going, I don't want a problem with the engine and the oil and an engine fire, so I'm totally on board with this, with the pilot, while he's saying they have put the wrong oil, they believe, in the engine. They can't be sure what oil has gone in the engine, so we are going to have to drain the oil out of the engine, which is going to take more than 45 minutes for that to happen because of the amount of oil and how long the process takes. So unfortunately, this flight is not just delayed, this flight is going to be canceled. So all of you need to deplane with your belongings and go check with the gate agents and go check with the airline about reschedule. Oh my God. So now you got mayhem. And we easily have 200 plus people on the plane that are ready to kill over the wrong oil in the engine. And this is a Friday afternoon. A lot of people are going to miss their connection. I believe that Pittsburgh was the connecting airport. A lot of people are going to miss their connection in Pittsburgh to go wherever else. I mean, there's mayhem in the gate. Again, I remember being with the basketball team, and they ended up having a later flight on US Air that we could get on nonstop. And the travel coordinator for USF had already been working on this with the backup flight, and he dealt with a travel agency, and we were all able to get on that flight. It was easily like 5-6 hours later. So we spent another 5 or 6 hours in the Tampa airport. Not horrible. Didn't have to go back home, or you're not in a different city where you have to go to a hotel overnight. But the oil in the engine being incorrect, KO'd that one. And no, we did not have to take a train and we did not have to take an automobile, but we eventually did get to Pittsburgh. As it turns out,
I don't have a lot of flying stories. A lot of mine have been pretty smooth. It seems like every time I go to Vegas, there's some kind of tornado or something back in Fort Worth and Dallas. So we're always having to sit there and wait to get on the plane because of the weather in Dallas. And that tends to happen a lot. I had one funny when we had gone to Arizona to see the Dallas Cowboys play the Arizona Cardinals back when they first got their new stadium, which at the time I believe was called University of Phoenix Stadium. And it was a real fun trip out there. It turns out they had a NASCAR race that weekend too. So Phoenix was just the place to be in DFW with sports fans. Because we had gone to a Suns game in downtown Phoenix. You name it, it was a great, great trip. But we're on the plane to go back, and something we're sitting there.
It was I'm just going to interject. It was a great trip until I knew there was a punchline. There's coming until
dun dun, like the Law and Order music dun dun. So I'm sitting on the front row of coach. So we're sitting and waiting and waiting, and in the first class area in front of us is this legendary columnist from Dallas Fort Worth area named Randy Galloway.
Yep.
And we get to hear him. Essentially, he was a writer for the Dallas Morning News and the Fort Worth Star Telegram for a long time, and he had a afternoon sports talk show on ESPN Radio here in Dallas Fort Worth.
Know him
and
well.
He had his Monday show from 3 to 6. We essentially got to hear it while we were waiting because he's sitting there, and it was really funny because it entertained the heck out of all of us, and he was such a funny guy, you know, and really, really fun to listen to. So that's probably the worst actual time I've had as far as a wait, because it was about a 2.5 hour wait, but it was offset by the great Randy Galloway. So lastly, I want to throw in Thanksgiving. A lot of people know that you and I have known each other a long time, and what they may not know is the way we became to know each other was from your time on Fox Sports Radio.
Right.
Specifically when I would come on your show on Thanksgiving from being at the Dallas Cowboys.
Okay, so let me explain. I was hired by them working out of Tampa, out of my home studio or out of the radio station in Tampa to do Saturday nights on Fox Sports Radio. So I was the Saturday night host usually from 10 p.m. Eastern until either 1 or 2 a.m. Eastern, depending on the shift, every Saturday night. And then I would also fill in on holidays like Jay is talking about. I would frequently be fill-in nighttime host on Thanksgiving because somebody's got to talk Thanksgiving sports, all the football games from Thanksgiving. And you became like a staple of the Thanksgiving show because the Cowboys were always at home. You would come on the show like every year for like 3 or 4 years in a row.
Yeah, and wasn't that like the end of the night with Tony Bruno that you'd be in for him?
Right. I would fill in for him and for others and have the famous Jay on to talk to me about the Cowboys game. So wait a minute.
We would break down those games.
Right. Thanksgiving and you and me intertwined. But again, it doesn't involve you having to take a train, an automobile, or a plane to be on the show. So it's good.
But it involves me being in a building, AT&T Stadium, with 100,000 people. And while we're breaking down these Thanksgiving football games, you asked me what they were serving in the media room.
I wanted to know. Did they still have the Thanksgiving meal on Thursday night? I still remember at the old Texas Stadium, not the new one, the AT&T Stadium, the Buccaneers and John Gruden back in 2006, we played the Cowboys on Thanksgiving Day. And my wife and I were actually just recently talking about that Thanksgiving, which is now 12 years ago at the time that we're talking, and it's 2 years before we had our twin daughter, so it's been a little while. But that year she went with her family and they had Thanksgiving at Cracker Barrel. And the reason that they did that is because I was gone. My parents weren't going to be coming over. So they had and Thanksgiving meal was evidently great at Cracker Barrel. That day, because I joked, I had Thanksgiving dinner on a paper plate in the Cowboys press box with the turkey and the dressing, sitting with the former Cowboys player and the former NFL coach with the Broncos and the Falcons and the Giants, Dan Reed, who was doing the game on radio. I sat at the table with Dan Reeves. You're talking about Randy Galloway. I sat at the table with Dan Reeves having
my turkey
and dressing on a paper plate for Thanksgiving while we're talking about Thanksgiving in Dallas and DFW. But yeah, that is how you and I hooked up. I would always want to know what your eats were out in the parking lot and that kind of stuff.
Tell me, what was the tailgating like? What was the food like in the media?
I cared more about that. I cared more than that. I mean, we all saw the game. I cared more about what kind of eats you got. I was always looking out for you and your nutritional value on Thanksgiving because we all get the calories just from looking about at whatever's on the food and on the plate.
Well, the good news is, like I said, I was able to take my own car I did not have to deal with marathon car rental like Steve Martin did in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And the this movie is rated R, as we might have mentioned earlier. It seems like a PG movie, but it's rated R for this one particular scene.
Yes.
Where they take him out to get his rental car and drop him off, and the space is empty. That being because Del Griffith has already picked his car up. But he walks back in, what did he say, about 3 miles or so to get back in. And the attendant is the woman who plays the secretary in Ferris Bueller's Day
Off.
Yes,
yes.
And so very another John Hughes flick, and he says the F word 18 times in a 60-second period.
Wait, you counted this or somebody else counted this?
I counted it.
You counted 18 times. And Edie McClurg is the car rental agent.
Correct,
of course,
Edie McClurg.
And Edie McClurg, also famous, by the way, because I was a bigger fan of this than you, WKRP in Cincinnati. She's Herb's wife as a recurring character. Herb is the salesman with the white belt and the white shoes, working with Les Nessman in the sales office. And she's tremendous in these little bit parts in the John Hughes movie. So she's just having to take the wrath of Steve Martin. So 18 F-bombs in 60 seconds.
Yes, and basically she tells him, you're effed.
so
he's screwed in more ways than one. So let's kind of start wrapping this bad boy up. We often on our show kind of go through some like fun facts and trivia. Let's see what I've got here. We've got, apparently this has been stated by both John Candy and Steve Martin that this is their favorite movie of theirs.
Well,
so both of them love this.
I think both of them do such a good job, and I know we got to talk about the ending, because again, you know, you're trying to figure out while watching this, and I'm trying to remember in 87. I don't think I saw this in the theater. I think this was Blockbuster VHS for me for the first time that I saw this one. But I can't remember. I kept remembering back to the first time I watched it, I'm going, how is this going to end? What's going to happen here? How are they going to get home? You're wondering, you're trying to figure out how are they going to get home? And ultimately the climax is they do sort of get back home, but then it occurs to Neil, to Steve Martin's character, what's really going on with John Candy's Dell at the end of it. So the ending of the movie, I think that's what makes the movie last as long as it has and have the impact it has, is the ending. It actually has a touching ending at the end of it, a great Thanksgiving story.
Very, very happy ending, because he's on the train going home. They've gone their separate ways, and he is kind of thinking back to their little journey. He kind of puts two and two together from some of the just small things he said, like, oh, I hadn't been home in years, or whatever, little things like
and
that.
By the way, I should mention, while you're talking about this, we're playing the same music that we played at the beginning of the show right now on this part of the show, because this is the montage music where they're playing all of the funny scenes, and Neil is thinking about all the things, but then he's also thinking about the things that Del told him, Jay, and now he's putting it together.
Right, and this, it's where he realizes, and you know, we see him just kind of uptight, you know, executive kind of guy that nobody likes, you know, and he's always just really just unhappy about things. And then you kind of see him laughing and smiling, and you realize that, you know, he does have a good heart, and he is a good guy, and he ends up going back to the train station and seeing Del sitting there with his trunk.
And realizes that Del has nowhere to go, or at least it dawns on him here, there's a reason why Del has nowhere to go, and that's because his wife had died, eight years earlier, and so at the end of this, it becomes, it's sad, it tugs at you, because he has nowhere to go, and now Neil and the Page family are going to end up hosting Del. He's going to bring Del and that maniac situation with him into their home, but it's great for the holidays. Nobody should be alone.
Shows him walking
for the
down the street,
right.
You know, down his street carrying the trunk, and you know, all he's talked about to his wife is this knucklehead that he's been with on the road, and all he's talked to Del about is his family, his wife, right? So the two of them, you know, they make eye contact and instantly, you know, hello, Mrs. Page, hello, Mr. Griffith, you know, and it's just a really happy ending, and it kind of makes you think that, you know, Del, because Del's a good guy, he's just lonely, you know, and that's the thing, he's got people that he knows when he travels, because what he does, he's a traveling salesman, so he knows people in every town, he knows the cab driver, he knows the guy that works at the motels and stuff, but, you know, he doesn't have any family, and that's kind of what this is like for him, is it gives him some family.
Well, and it's a very, I love the way that John Hughes did this. It's a well-written movie in that regard. And I think we can all identify that you want to be kind in the holiday season to people because not everybody has the same family or has family. And so you want to take care of them. You want to do what you can to take care of them. So that's a neat touching part of this. All right. So you want to get into a little bit of the trivia again? I didn't mean to sidetrack you on that.
No, you're fine. In the airport scene in Wichita, where we had Ben Stein, who was also in Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yes.
He's the guy at the desk, and he announces that the flight's been canceled. On the board behind him, you can see the destination of the flight is nowhere.
Yes.
So that's a pretty funny one. You've also got the exterior of the aircraft is the same 707 flying through the storm in the movie Airplane, which was also released by Paramount Pictures.
How about that? All right. So you just have to save on the special effects. Didn't have a big – what, the movie didn't have a humongous budget. What was it, like a $30 million budget, something like that? So
I believe $30 million was the budget, yes. So it certainly made plenty of that back and over. Here's one that says there's a DVD, the Those Aren't Pillows edition DVD. John Hughes says he was inspired to write the film story after an actual flight from New York to Chicago he was on was diverted to Wichita, Kansas, and it actually took him 5 days to get back to Chicago. So by the time he got back to Chicago, he was already supposed to be back in New York.
Well,
so,
and that's a good impetus.
You hear all these
impetus.
Based on a true story things. This actually is based on a true story.
Based on a John Hughes true story, and I wonder if he encountered a salesman that was selling something and he made it into shower curtain rings or if he made that up out of whole cloth. I love that. I love those kind of insight in trivia nuggets. All right, anything else? What else do you have on the trivia?
More fun stuff. We have John Hughes wrote the first draft of the screenplay in only 3 days.
Wow.
Yeah,
but you would figure with what you're
writing knows that's really fast.
Well, with what you just told me, he experienced this, and so he's writing off his experiences as opposed to just off the cuff or off the top of your head. You're trying to create. You're actually able to dwell on what you went through and help you write the movie. That makes sense.
This also makes it like he didn't sleep for those times because it said his average time for writing movies was 3 to 5 days with 20 something rewrites. How about that?
Wow.
Yeah.
So
here's a good one. We've got John Hughes shot over 600,000 feet of film, almost twice the industry average. And the rumored 3-hour version of the film does exist, although it's not in order. And moreover, it's a mess of footage that would take months, maybe even years, according to Hughes, to transform into an actual film. It's locked away somewhere in a Paramount vault. And according to John Hughes, most of it is probably deteriorated.
Yeah. How about that?
So there's somewhere
I would love to know,
there would have been a director's version of this.
I would have loved to have known it. Was there a good scene, if not a funny, humorous, memorable scene that we never saw in the deleted scenes? And is that on the Those Aren't Pillows DVD, maybe a deleted scene or two? But you're saying it never saw the light of day because Hughes has already passed away.
There are some scenes that were deleted.
Yeah, how about that?
That made it. Here's one that says John Candy and Steve Martin eat dinner on the plane in the scene that's not in the theatrical version, but it's in the one that airs on television. So if you see it like on TNT or AMC or something, they've got some, you know, some footage that they throw in to kind of fit the time allotted, if you will. And the scene ends with a long-haired passenger in front of Steve Martin letting his or her hair cascade down onto Martin's brownie, completely covering it. seeing that Martin is no longer hungry, John Candy fishes through the hair to retrieve it and eat the brownie.
That's perfect Dell there for the
that
movie.
Is typical Dell. So let's see what else we have. In New Zealand, even though you have the infamous, I was right, 18 F-words under a minute scene, the movie was rated PG.
How about that?
It's not rated R everywhere.
What's amazing, just while we have a little sidebar, we haven't talked about this recently. I think we did this on a previous one maybe a while ago, is that when you talk about the standards of what is PG, what is PG-13, and what is R, it's amazing the level of violence that we have just almost become numb to and expect that is allowed now to be a PG movie. When back 20, 30 years ago, when we're talking about the genres and the times that we were watching movies, I mean, with the level of violence that are in movies now, those would have been automatic rated R movies. They're now PG or PG-13. But if you say a version of the F word or the F word, you're guaranteed an R rating. I mean, you could have 73 people murdered with headshots being blown up and body parts everywhere. That's PG-13 still. And yet the F word gets included in a movie that doesn't even have blood, gore, violence, and it's rated R. It's crazy.
I think you can get away with one or two F-words and still get PG-13. But yeah, definitely the language.
I don't know.
You got the Bible belt, stuff like that. You got to.
Exactly. I'm in this. I don't know from the, again, we don't have the Academy of Motion Picture and Sciences here to tell us, but I think one of those, you're looking at an R rating, just because most people don't want to have their kids exposed to that. Unless they're 17 or 18, you still have that idealistic view that they're not hearing it all the time at school or with their friends or wherever they are in the neighborhood. But anyway, I digress on what makes a movie rated R. So it's just interesting that it wasn't rated R everywhere.
Well, you know, and I don't even remember a time when we didn't have PG-13, but, you know, like on our Rocky IV podcast, I was mentioning, I love listening to this one called 80s All Over. And one of their recent episodes, they were talking about PG-13 kind of coming about from Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, because those were both so intense, they probably didn't need to be seen by little kids, but they were, you know, they weren't rated R. They weren't bad enough to be R, but they were a little hard for PG. So
exactly. You know, kind of, so it's kind of a medium.
Of it that way.
Kind of a medium. Exactly. And then eventually spawning out of that came the NC-17 rating, where it was over the top rated R with sex, violence, vulgarity, and it was an even higher level of make sure you don't have anyone under 18 in here because of this for any reason, even with a parent. So and then that has basically gone by the wayside.
NC-17 was supposed to kind of make it a little more commercial as opposed to being rated X, you know, because like if it was a Basic Instinct type movie and they would have to edit scenes to get rated R, the NC-17 was supposed to take care of that. And then I remember Henry and June's the first one I remember being NC-17, had Uma Thurman. And then there's only one I remember, Showgirls from 95 with Elizabeth Berkley. That's the only one I remember.
But my point is, you're exactly right. It's basically
most of them the only part of it.
It's basically gone away because the studios, the filmmakers have tailored it to where you don't have that rating anymore. So that's just interesting. I didn't mean to digress on the rating part of it. But yeah, the F word that is flying in this movie, just be aware of it if you're going to watch it again and around the holidays, especially with kids. It's there. If you're not watching it on cable, if you're not watching it, as Jay said, TNT, AMC, or one of those shows, because it is slated to be on in and around Thanksgiving holiday time here. Just be careful.
Yeah, it was originally on a lot. Here's we'll kind of wrap up our little fun facts. We've got John Hughes had wanted Tom Hanks for the role of Neil Page and John Travolta for the role of Del Griffith.
Interesting.
Hanks was unavailable because he was shooting Big. Paramount executives decided they did not want Travolta in the movie because he was considered, quotes, box office poison at the time.
How about that?
Yeah, he's had some ups and downs.
Big.
I'm sure we'll do some Travolta stuff in the future, and we can definitely dive into his stuff. Lastly, on the trivia, says after the credits, if you wait, Neil's boss is still at his desk analyzing the ads. his Thanksgiving dinner sitting on the desk. So just so you know, he's still looking at those. In fact, he's probably still looking at them as we speak.
That's exactly right. If he wasn't looking at Sloan, Ferris Bueller's girlfriend, out the cab, he was analyzing all of the data in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Well, another thing we like to do when we're wrapping up the show is we look back at what some of the critics said back when the movie came out. And we've got Roger Ebert from the Siskel and Ebert show that we grew up loving. And he gave – you're going to love this one. He gave Planes, Trains, and Automobiles 4 stars, a perfect rating. And he listed it in his – he's got a list of 300 great movies, and this is one of them. This is in Roger Ebert's list of great movies. How about that?
And he believes it was John Candy's quintessential role, his best role. And again, Candy had such a background in comedy and comedic movies, but he said this one – and it does, because again, it's a comedy, but it's got a great story behind it and a really touching ending behind it. I mean, I realize that some of our audience, they're not going to identify the same way that we are with kind of the wholesome family, you know, feel good, good ending. You know, they're more interested in the action packed, you know, Schwarzenegger, you know, we talked about Stallone and First Blood when we were talking about Rocky and all the violent movies. This one has, Hughes did a great job. It has a great ending to it about family and about holiday time and about how Steve Martin's Neil is reaching out to John Candy and his Dell character. And so it works. And Ebert, I know Ebert loved that and loved John Candy playing in that role.
And here's a couple of the highlights of this. It's a really long article on the great movies thing where we have Ebert says the last scenes of the movie carry the emotional payoff that we've been half awaiting all along. For Neil, they reflect a kind of moral rebirth, such as Scrooge experiences in Another Great Holiday Tale. He's learned his lesson and will no longer judge people by their appearance or by his own selfish standards. This is true poignancy in the scene where Neil finds Del waiting alone on the L platform. It says, and here's something that's kind of cool. It says, one night a few years after Planes, Trains, Automobiles was released, I came upon John Candy sitting all by himself in a hotel bar in New York, smoking and drinking, and we talked for a while. We were going to be on the same TV show the next day, but he was really depressed. People loved him, but he didn't seem to know that, or it wasn't enough. He was a sweet guy, and nobody had a word to say against him, but he was really down on himself. All he wanted to do was make people laugh, but sometimes he tried too hard, and he hated himself for doing that in some of his movies. And it made me think of Del. There is so much truth in the role. It transforms the whole movie. Hughes knew it, and he captured it again, and Only the Lonely, and Steve Martin knew it, and he played straight into it. It says, the movies that last, the ones we return to, don't always have lofty themes or complexities. Sometimes they last because they are arrows straight to the heart. When Neil unleashes that tirade in the motel room and Del's face saddens, he says, oh, I see. It is a moment that not only defines Del's life, but is a turning point in Neil's, because he also is a lonely soul and too well organized to know it. Strange how poignancy creeps into this comedy and only becomes stronger while we're laughing.
There you go.
So that wraps it up. You can't say it any better than that from the late, great Roger Ebert about the late, great John.
Well, we always assume that most of our audience has seen the movie that we're talking about on We've Seen That Here and take that for granted. But I would think if you put 20 people in a room and say to them, does the ending work for you? And do you identify with this because of holiday time and taking care of family members and even strangers sometimes at holiday time? All 20 of them would say yes, because this, if you like this movie, that's the reason you liked this movie. That's the reason why you enjoyed this movie, was for the ending. So
it's a Thanksgiving movie. We've talked about this, how there's so many Christmas movies, whether it's Christmas Vacation, right, or Scrooge or Christmas Story or Home Alone. But this is a movie around Thanksgiving about a guy wanting to get home to see his family. You know, it's a little different than a lot of the Christmas movies we have. And it's just, it's a special movie. And hopefully, us talking about it will have people want to go revisit it and find it. And when we were looking for it, it's available. It's on Amazon. It's on YouTube Movies. You can find it all over the place. In some cases, it's like $2. You know, $2 well spent.
And in and around Thanksgiving weekend, it'll be shown several times on over-the-air regular cable TV, too, I'm sure, from different cable outlets that are going to be showing it. So, well worth the watch on that. And again, a great story behind it. I know I've said that several different times. When you talk about other Thanksgiving movies, I mean, there are not a lot of them. There are a couple of prominent ones. We will probably come around to Scent of a Woman with Al Pacino, which, you know me, Pacino is arguably one of my top two or three actors that I love, and this is an iconic role for him, playing Lieutenant Colonel Frank Slade, who's blind, and it's a Thanksgiving weekend setting with he and Chris O'Donnell in Scent of a Woman. Tremendous movie from 1992, I believe it is, centered around Thanksgiving, so that one stands out. And then how about this?
Well, let me say one thing about Scent of a Woman. I haven't seen it in a while. I mean, it's an entertaining movie. The one thing that I know, he got his Oscar for Scent of a Woman, but the one thing about that is that's where Pacino transformed from the Pacino we knew from The Godfathers to this, you know, crazy guy that'll start yelling in all of his movies. Like, even, you know, my favorite Pacino movie we've talked about is Heat.
Right.
With him and Robert De Niro, and he even screams in that one. He just he literally goes off the top, I always kind of equate that back to Scent of a Woman with the hoo-ah and all that, you know?
Yes, I'm just getting warmed up. Well, he's got numerous different movies in and around this and after this where he seems to give the big speech, where he seems to have the big moment, like what's in Scent of a Woman. But again, the purpose that I'm bringing it up here on We've Seen That for this episode, for Thanksgiving and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, is that one is set in Thanksgiving in New York. And having just been in New York last weekend, they've got everything set up. They've got the tree up at Rockefeller Center. They're getting ready for the Christmas holiday, and then eventually the ball drop in Times Square. So you know it's in and around that time of year. And speaking of that, Miracle on 34th Street, the iconic Christmas movie, Jimmy Stewart from so long ago, that gets shown over and over again in and around the Christmas holiday and even Christmas night. What is it, NBC, that always shows it on Christmas night?
That NBC show shows, It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life. Okay, well, yeah. Miracle on 34th Street, though, I believe it is, it begins with the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and that's the initial setting about how it begins and goes into motion with Santa Claus. So,
there's a lot of different versions of that one. There's one from back in the 40s that I know Maureen O'Hara was in. The only one I've actually seen, and that's the one where they put Santa Claus on trial, right?
That's right.
I've actually seen is the one from the mid-90s. It's got Richard Attenborough playing Santa and Dylan McDermott's in it.
There you go.
Elizabeth Perkins. I enjoyed that one. That's a good movie.
So there you go. So there's a couple of other, and people may be naming off and thinking of other ones that are centered around Thanksgiving, but those are a couple that just come to mind for me. They're not. Your point is well taken. They're not a lot of them. Certainly not the same way as Christmas, which we'll get to soon enough with the holidays, and we've seen that.
I'm looking forward to it. There's a lot of Christmas movies to go through, and only a few we can do. So if you have any suggestions for us, feel free to hit us up on social media.
Yes, no doubt about that. We've seen that on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. You can find him as well at The Famous Jay. Maybe you've got some comments on Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with Steve Martin and with John Candy. It's only fitting that we're going to go out here from the soundtrack, because this is, I have to say, it's not every time, but a lot of the time, this is the way I feel when our show comes to an end, is that every time you go away, you take a piece of me with you, Jay Betzel.
I don't know that it's quite that emotional. I usually think of it as I'm looking forward to the next one.
Yes, we are looking forward to many more episodes, including getting to our Christmas time ones as well. Did you have fun here talking about this 1987 comedy classic with a great ending, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Steve Martin, John Candy, John Hughes, how can you go wrong?
You cannot go wrong. And we encourage the audience, if you haven't seen it recently, see it again. And thanks for hanging in here on the show with the catalog of all the different shows that we have. We're going to get to something that you like, you enjoy, you remember probably on every episode, if not every other episode. We'll get to something that you can obviously relate to, at least we hope to anyway. And we do a vast array of movies, from comedy to drama to action to sports. That's what we do here. Access that catalog through the Apple Podcast, through Stitcher, through Google Play, etc., etc. And our friends at Radio Influence do a great job of helping us promote what we have on. This one works, though, because of the Thanksgiving holiday, does it not, sir?
It works because it's a great movie. You can watch this in the middle of summer. It's just a fun movie to watch. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody, and thanks for listening.
Yes, and I want to find out what Jay is having on the Thanksgiving Day buffet for the game with the Cowboys and the Redskins, the traditional Thanksgiving game that they're going to be playing coming up at the time that we're taping this. Happy Thanksgiving, folks. Famous Jay, I had a blast. Thank you for talking Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with me.
Thanks, everybody.
All right, that'll do it. Thank you, Jay Betzel. I'm TJ Reeves. It is We've Seen That on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram. And we thank you for being with us here as we talk Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Happy holidays, the holiday season beginning. We'll be back soon with another edition of We've Seen That. Bye.
This is a Tennis with an Accent quick fix on Radio Influence.
Today, we have Mark Woodford, who returns to the podcast for the third time. This was the 10th year of the tournament in London. So let me start with a generic question. Are you in favor for this tournament to stay in cities that already have major tennis presence, or you think a little mix-up would be okay to bring it to non-tennis cities, something that Laver Cup is already doing? But what's your view on that?
I was there at the ATP finals last year for the whole week, and that was the first time that I had visited the O2 Arena, and I was absolutely blown away by the environment. The setup at the arena is so brilliant, and it's extremely well attended. I think if you're watching it at home, you know, you can see the amount of people. I mean, there's barely a spare seat. And this is at the end of the year. It's at the end of the tennis season. They're trying to sell two sessions, you know, during the day and the evening. And obviously the attraction is all of the elite players, singles and doubles, are there participating. It's an incredible event. And the English or the British public do come out in droves to support it. And that's what the tennis players, I think we aspire to play in front of crowds. It helps with the emotion, you know, inspires you to perhaps play play at an elevated level. And of course, you're playing for this crown of being, the World Tour Finals, and potentially improve your ranking. So they have done an amazing job, the ATP Tour, with its current position there in London.
Tennis with an Accent with Saqib Ali and Matt Zemek can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.